Welcome to this series, Overcoming a Sense of Academic Failure, which has been prepared and produced through collaboration between me, Emily Trushenko, and the University of Oxford Career Service. Other voices are those of early, mid, and late career researchers within and beyond academia. They all have experience of some of the failure-related feelings we'll be exploring, and insights to share about how to understand them and what to do with them. If the material we cover raises questions or concerns in you, we suggest you contact your university's careers service or counselling service. And as we continue to build these resources over the coming years, we'd love to hear what you think of the podcasts, what resonated with you or helped you, what you think could be changed or added. You can find a web form on the Oxford Careers Service website at careers.ox.ac.uk/overcoming-failure.
This podcast is part of an initiative designed to make it okay to talk not just about our successes, but also about failure in academia and beyond. This instalment focuses on the feeling of failure. In the following episodes, we'll move on to the role of other people in feelings of failure and our responses to those feelings, then the importance of contemplating what can sometimes seem the greatest professional failure of all, leaving academia. And finally, some ideas for attitudes and actions that might change your relationship with failure. You might also like to take a look at the written document we've put together called Overcoming a Sense of Academic Failure, which explores similar ideas in slightly different ways. Every life and every academic career includes both success and failure, and the default attitude tends to be an unreflective kind of positive thinking. Academia is a tough road, but we must keep trying and stay optimistic. The academic version of keep calm and carry on. But pretending everything is okay is not the only option. An alternative way of thinking is that if you're feeling that you have failed, or even if you're feeling that you are a failure, it is better to acknowledge that feeling than try to ignore it. Once you have, you can set your feelings in context and move on from a position of greater understanding. Like publishing negative results in science, acknowledging what has happened allows us to learn from what didn't go to plan and lets others see that no academic career is a neat progression from success to success.
In science, failure is accepted as part of not being able to reproduce someone's data is great because you've shown that there was a problem in their experimental model. So that's fine. In the humanities, not being able to do what you set out in your proposal to do might have a knock-on effect on your research for the next 20, 30 years. And that might simply be because you hadn't realised there was a flaw in the model, which is great because it's really good to realise that some models are flawed and others aren't. So I think in the humanities, we do have a bit of a problem around failure. We're not quite willing to embrace it enough.
This approach was popularised a few years ago with some academic CVs of failure that attracted quite a bit of attention. And once you start noticing it, you realise that the idea of failure has a particular fascination, cropping up all over the place in articles, radio programmes, and even a Swedish museum of failure, featuring Colgate lasagna and various other bad commercial ideas. Some people think this has gone too far. American satirist Joe Queenan, for instance, presented a Radio 4 programme called A Brief History of Failure, in which he railed against the idea of failure, and especially the romance of defeat or failure chic, which he suggests the British are particularly susceptible to, brought up as we are to honour cultural heroes like Scott of the Antarctic for their dignity in the face of defeat. Others reject the term failure altogether because it implies three things that we need to avoid: permanence, the idea that a failure can be forever; pervasiveness, the idea that failure can be everything; and personalisation, the idea that I can be a failure.
I don't like the word failure, because to me failure is it puts you on a pass-fail, and I think there's a spectrum, and I think there is no such thing as failure. For me, failure is not trying. So if an opportunity presents, then I give it a go. If I don't make it, that's fine. I accept that, that's my own acceptance, but that's not failure. The failure for me personally would have been to not put in the grant or not give the paper a go or not try the opportunity. So it's not a pass-fail how I see it, and that's very much the ethos in my group, is we give things a go. If they don't work out first time, then we regroup. You're allowed a day, 24 hours to feel sorry for yourself, and then life continues because it's not terminal.
Not getting what you want is probably a better characterization of the experience of graduates and postdocs than failure. Failure is an awfully big word. It is true that people end up in professions that are different from, or jobs that are different from those that they expected and wanted when they were graduates, for example. But that isn't necessarily in itself failure. It's a different direction. Failure turns it into something bigger, but it is important to confront this all the same. It's important to confront it, but also it's important to confront it to get past it.
So there are arguments for using different words, like setback or challenge, or times when things don't go well. But there are also arguments for calling the experience what it feels like, acknowledging the feeling, and only then challenging its premises.
I don't think we can preempt those feelings, but I think we have to realize they are just feelings. It's really almost like you could take a piece of paper and say, okay, have I prepared for this job or for this proposal or that? If the answer is yes, then the next point is, how much time have I spent? Was it sufficient? And then if the answer is yes and you are still not chosen, you say, well, tough. I didn't have luck in this case. And that actually helps to dispel this feeling.
In his book, The Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck, self-help author Mark Manson argues that the fixation on the positive found in much conventional life advice can often just end up making you focus on what you lack. Those offering apparent solutions will laser in on what you already think are your shortcomings and failures and emphasize them. That's right, you're really not beautiful, rich, creative, or lovable enough. Some suffering is simply inevitable. Things will suck sometimes. You will be inadequate sometimes. Happiness, effectiveness, and other good things come from accepting and then surmounting the negative experiences associated with them, like the failure that helps you understand something better, or the muscle pain from lifting weights that means you're getting stronger. What doesn't help is ignoring the negative or trying to silence it. Manson writes, "The avoidance of suffering is a form of suffering. The avoidance of struggle is a struggle. The denial of failure is a failure. Hiding what is shameful is itself a form of shame. Pain is an inextricable thread in the fabric of life, and to tear it out is not only impossible, but destructive. Attempting to tear it out unravels everything else with it." So instead of violently yanking out the thread, here we'll be tracing failure's course, seeing where it gets tangled with other things and how they might be separated out. The seed of this initiative was sown in a lunchtime talk called Overcoming a Sense of Failure in Academia back in 2012, which I didn't actually go to, but whose title stayed with me. In the summer of 2016, I ran an expanded version by the name Overcoming a Sense of Academic Failure, which involved 7 apparently highly successful speakers talking in small groups to 30-odd DPhil students and postdocs from across all 4 academic divisions at Oxford, and pooling the fruits of their discussions at the end. From that grew a written resource, which also includes excerpts from some of the speakers' CVs of failure.
In the little groups with the students, they were so obviously anxious about their future, uncertain what to do, and I felt like an old person who could say, it's all right there. That was part of it. I mean, that sounds rather condescending, but no, it was lovely to hear their views on it and to remember what it's like at their stage, and then to reflect on what actually happened in my life, which I never could have possibly imagined when I was their age. The other thing I enjoyed about it was meeting famous people who'd had failures too, and that was quite striking to me, particularly to meet Robin Dunbar, whose work I've admired, and realised that he'd actually got into all that famous work rather late in his career and done a whole lot of other things too. So I learnt from both sides, as it were.
I was really pleased that you have this idea of doing this seminar, because for me it was really like facing all these things which one could see as failures, but when I saw how much of my time went to it, I was absolutely absorbed from these sins.
And then the career service got involved. Their advisors often see early career academics lose confidence at some point during their time at Oxford, and sometimes get stuck further on in their careers in lasting feelings of failure. When feeling you have failed becomes a limiting belief, when it makes you fear to try new things in case you fail again, that is when it becomes really dangerous and sad. Nonetheless, we can still find ourselves resisting the idea that the concept of failure needs time and space from us. If you find it hard to persuade yourself or allow yourself to admit that failure does actually matter, take it from someone well known for having gone through multiple failures on the way to enormous successes, J.K. Rowling. As she puts it, "It is impossible to live without failing at something, unless you live so cautiously that you might as well not have lived at all, in which case you fail by default." The point she's making is that failure is inevitable. Whenever you try something difficult or new, you risk failing. But in that sense, failing can be good, because it's a sign you tried something that was not guaranteed to work. Failing can also teach you a lot about where you went wrong and how not to in the future. On the other hand, feeling that you are a failure is neither inevitable nor good. It can eat you up from the inside.
I have failed because I'm not clever enough.
Academia can be particularly effective at inducing this kind of existential feeling that I didn't just do something that failed, but I myself am a failure. Everything I am and have done adds up to that. This can make us feel embarrassed or ashamed or worthless, and so make us keep silent about the things that go wrong. This creates a dangerously distorted view of reality that benefits no one, because everything is based on pretense. Here we could again raise the analogy with scientific publishing. If no one ever acknowledges and makes public their negative results, we learn nothing, not really. In both areas, change will happen only if we make it. And attending carefully and honestly to our own experiences is one place to start. After all, finding a solution, if there is one, requires understanding the problem. So it might be worth spending a few minutes now and then asking yourself, when I feel I'm failing now, or have just failed, or will do in the future, what exactly am I feeling? Where do the feelings come from, and what can I learn from them? In particular, you could try posing to yourself a little sequence of questions like this. Is failure for me right now more a subjective or an objective problem? It's objective if someone sensible would agree with you that you have just failed at something. If you are sitting with an objective failure, ask, can I remember a subjective one? And vice versa. Does an objective failure have more jagged edges than a subjective one? Is a subjective one more insidious, creeping more easily into my self-perception? What is it that makes this feeling I'm feeling so unpleasant? Are there dark corners of the feeling that I'm afraid to look at head on? Might I be confusing failure and guilt? How would I know? Might I be confusing failure and deviation from my career plan A? How would I know? Is this feeling about me, or about what other people may think of me, or about what I think other people may think of me? Are the standards I set myself so high I was bound to fail? Am I so tired and anxious I can't think or feel anything clearly except tiredness and anxiety? Do I feel in this moment that I'm an imposter? That I've sneaked my way to somewhere I don't deserve to be? And that all my past successes are a charade on the verge of being found out? Does how I feel about my failure relate to how I approach my successes? For instance, would I look at a list of all the good and happy things that have happened in my life and think, that's all just down to luck, while blaming the bad stuff, like what's just happened, on myself? Keep sitting with this particular feeling of failure for a while. Do you notice that anything changes as you stay with it? If you return to this practice of attending to your feelings for a second or a third time, does more change? Does your perspective on your failures feel any different? The feeling, of course, is not all there is. You've come to know it a little better. Now, what do you do with it? First, except one crucial fact about failure. It cannot be avoided except by stopping trying anything.
My one-year master became a two-year MPhil. I remember the final exams at the examination school in June in my full subfusc. And I remember feeling that there was really a survival, you just live or die kind of situation. But it made me stronger.
So ask yourself now, what kind of outcome do you seek? What for you would make having listened to this podcast worthwhile? Does the outcome you want lie in the comfort of making your feelings of failure go away or turn into something else? Or would the comfort of knowing them to be normal perhaps be enough? If normality might be enough for you, our task is simple. It is an undisputable fact that many people often feel like failures.
Now, coming from the Italian university, it was rather difficult for me to adjust to the Oxford system. Or rather, I should say, to understand how it worked first and then to adjust. One of the situations where I sort of felt I was really not doing very well was the context of the tutorial. I just didn't know how to deal with sources. I didn't know that the readings were there for me to develop an opinion, an idea of my own. Coming from Italy, I thought that what was expected from me was just to learn things by heart. And it was really, really difficult, especially when I was asked within the tutorial setting, yes, but what do you think? I just could not deal with it because I didn't think I was entitled to have an idea. So, you know, the authority was the authority. How on earth was I supposed to say anything that deviated from it? So that was a very difficult situation. And I remember feeling a deep, strong sense of failure.
I had plenty of failures, which I didn't notice. I didn't get a JRF. I didn't get the first four permanent posts I applied for, kind of thing. And in years where there were lots of them, shortly after I got mine, there weren't. But I barely noticed. That's an element of naivety, which nobody in their 20s could allow themselves now.
I just lurched from place to place. I only did a doctorate because my tutor at Oxford said, come with me to York and do a doctorate. And I just said yes, because that was an easy option. And then I went to do a postdoc with a man I'd met at York, a Canadian, and he seemed a nice bloke. And so I went there. There was no real good reason for it. So if you like, I failed to get an important postdoc position at, I don't know, Harvard or MIT or somewhere. And I went to the University of Alberta. And then I failed to get a job and so dropped out into publishing. And I failed to make a good publisher, so I dropped out into telly. And I failed to make a good producer, so I dropped out into presenting. So I failed again and again. And it was a question of, as I failed, grasping at any opportunity, you know, any rope or lifeline. And some of them worked.
If, as it turns out, you mucked up, then don't muck up the second time. So again, I failed Oxford entrance. I particularly wanted to come to Oxford, so I took it again. And if that's what you want to do, that's what you want to do. But of course, having since taught in many different universities, I realise that there are plenty of universities that I would have liked to go to. So some things are not the failures that they seem. It's up to you to decide whether it is or it isn't.
We shouldn't be tackling the issue of failure by trying to avoid it. We need to find ways of making it okay.
Part of the reason is that although a neat, straight path from undergraduate to professor may once have been the norm, it certainly isn't now. And even where it does happen, that doesn't make the progression as perfectly orderly and thoroughly full of successes as it might look from the outside. Everyone has rejections for jobs, grants, articles. Everyone has setbacks that aren't obvious to anyone else. Everyone has phases where they have no idea what they're doing. Think of someone you admire as successful and ask yourself, do I really think he or she never feels as I do when I feel like a failure or like I have failed? Even better, find such a person and talk to them. You might both learn something rather significant. So remember that you know a lot about yourself and very little about everyone else who seems successful or indeed unsuccessful.
We're all different. We all have things going on in our lives that people don't realise. So I've stopped looking at what my so-called peers achieve.
Well, maybe this helps you feel a little better, but not much. What next? How do you go about the alchemy of turning this, hopefully now more mildly unpleasant feeling, into something you can recognise as valuable? The first benefit of attending to your feelings of failure is the benefit of exposure therapy, of any practice that looks reality in the face rather than shying away from it. We're often told to try to overcome negative thinking, but without it we may lose touch with reality. A 2005 research paper by Kristin Neff and colleagues entitled Self-Compassion, Achievement Goals, and Coping with Academic Failure concluded that when individuals do attempt to repress or deny their negative emotions, the strategy inevitably backfires. Holding negative emotions in compassionate awareness is a more adaptive way of dealing with failure, so that one does not become inadvertently fixated on thoughts of inadequacy and self-doubt. In other words, attempts at avoidance only grant the thing you're trying to avoid more significance than it deserves. Like the spider in the corner that grows in your mind the longer you put off just catching it and putting it gently outside.
I think the important thing is that when you feel bad about not getting something you want, it is a good idea not to bottle it up. You will always find people who will relativise it for you. And even though you don't necessarily believe them, because they're often not necessarily telling the truth, it's best to get through this through dialogue. And people who bottle it up very often just internalise the whole procedure and it goes into a negative spiral. It is much better to talk it through, even if it's at 3 a.m. when you're drunk and you're being obsessive. It's still better to do that than not do it.
I didn't finish high school, so I didn't do my last year of high school and I didn't go straight into university. So then when I decided to go to university, I was pegging myself against everyone else that was there. I surprised myself, I guess, and did a PhD. I didn't think I was capable of doing that, so I underestimated my own capabilities. And I wouldn't say that I thought about that as I was a failure, it's just I wasn't capable. And then when I got my fellowship to come over here, it took me probably 9 months, a year, to realise that I was thinking I wasn't good enough, I wasn't succeeding, so I guess, for want of a better word, I was failing, to work out actually, no, I was doing okay because I was still here. I had come to Oxford, I was trying, and I was using everyone else's goalposts. They weren't my own. So I've stuck to my own goalposts. Suddenly I sat down and readdressed how I was going to do this in my head. And I very much came here with no career plan. And it's only in the last few years I've got that career plan. So it was me understanding that coming here was a big step. Just because I hadn't produced a paper in my first year and some of my peers had, that wasn't failure. Actually, that was me taking longer to gather data in a harder study. So it was being able to step back and put some perspective on why I felt like I wasn't maybe achieving what I should be. In reality, I was. And I think moving to a new country, I've now learned, and I tell people that come here, it takes a good at least 6 months to feel like you're embedded. Even if you know the work and the science, to feel like you're part of something and understand it, it takes longer than what you give yourself credit for. So it's about being kinder to yourself, I think. And that's been a hard lesson to learn. When you work in an institute that's based on outputs and titles, it's very hard not to put yourself on that pegging, but actually I think being a bit kinder to yourself, you achieve more and you understand yourself more.
One reason why accepting your reality can be so much more helpful than avoiding confronting it is that doing so properly means putting it in perspective. Part of this is the appreciation that others feel very similar things to you. That is, remembering that you are just one member of a species who share more than what distinguishes us. Another part of finding perspective is the ability to place now in the context of all the moments that have gone before and will come after.
All of us experience what we can see in retrospect or what we thought at the time as failure, and sometimes it matters subsequently and sometimes it doesn't.
Some people do say that everything is necessary to get to the place where you are, although you may not want to see it at that point. I think it's a nice viewpoint.
In this sense, it can be interesting to trace the origins of this kind of feeling. Have you felt like this only since coming to Oxford? Or did you already feel this way long before arriving here? Maybe failure for you is a new experience. Maybe you, like many at Oxford, had a glittering school career, and this is your first encounter with things that feel academically really hard. Maybe you or your family have sacrificed a lot to enable you to study or work at Oxford. Investing money or moving the family is bound to raise expectations for the future. Maybe there are other reasons too, like perfectionist tendencies nurtured by academia, that together have kept raising your bar for success higher and higher.
What is now called imposter syndrome is very, very highly gendered. It's quite useful that imposter syndrome now has a name. It didn't used to have a name because it means that you can confront it. But I think that in a world that's biased against women, the fact that women feel imposter syndrome even more than men does seem unfair. Inappropriate that you don't get to where you want to be, that you fail in inverted commas because you don't deserve it, is a bad idea. It's not what you want, but the idea that these doors are closed because someone has found you out, which I think is the most gendered aspect of it, I think is a mistake. And again, it's a good idea to recognise this so as to confront it, because it's wrong. I've known fellows of the British Academy, I've known dames of the British Empire who think at the age of 70 that someone is still going to find them out. They are all women.
The longer habits of thought and action last, the more entrenched they grow. If you can tease out one or more threads that connect your past to this present in which you feel like a failure, then you can ask yourself whether these threads would be better off broken. That past might be decades ago, but the way its ties are best severed is by working out how it continued to act through you today and deciding to do something different tomorrow. In the next podcast installment, we'll start to think about what that something different might look like. Meanwhile, remember that everything comes in waves. Every career has patches of greater and lesser productivity. And also, productivity isn't the only metric that matters. We're not conveyor belts. Nothing you do is a waste. The longer-term effects of all we do can take time to trickle through. And everything has its own structure. Success may feel dynamic and busy, while failure feels like nothing happening. Or the opposite, success may feel like effortless surfing and failure like endless effort or overwhelming slews of things happening to you. These dynamics have less power over us the more we recognize them as predictable.
People talk about life balance, but at the beginning of your career there is no such a thing. There is no life-work balance. You have to put a lot into work in order to build your basis. And you cannot give too much to others. I know it sounds horrible, but it is like that. Only when you are strong enough, you can truly interact with others and start giving and building your group if you work in the domain where you build groups. That's actually my personal experience. I work a lot on my own, but also with teams. And then in the middle of the career, you can slowly start to change that. And at the end of your career, you should be just giving. If you like, it's again Zen, because everything changes, so there is no such a thing. The balance changes every day, it's never static. But one thing I would say, that people should take some time for themselves, whichever way, whether they like to drink a bottle of wine, whether they like to swim, go for a run, or whatever, they must take some time to recuperate.
Now is not forever. And now matters. It can feel hard sometimes to do justice to both these truths, but really there's no contradiction. However awful today feels, it will pass. However wonderful it is, this too will pass, so enjoy it. In Zen, the source of all suffering is resisting change, clinging to what we desire, pushing away what we fear, rather than accepting that everything must pass.
I can just remember being in the little room with half a dozen students, and what I said to them is, there's no magic wand. I wish there were a magic wand that I could wave over you and it would show you that it's all going to be fine. If I had had a magic wand back when I was struggling with one of the kids in the playpen, the other one running around like a mad thing, and I'm desperately trying to write my book or whatever, and feeling, I think I felt very resentful that I had to be at home all the time and I didn't have a car, and their dad had a car and went to had a proper job and was getting on in the academic world, and I really didn't have those opportunities. I felt really oppressed and quite unhappy some of the time, even though I was enjoying the little bit of work I could do. If I could have had a magic wand and waved it then, that would have just told me, in 20 years' time, or in 30 years' time, you'll be absolutely fine. You'll have written loads of books. People will have read them. You'll have written all kinds of, you've been to amazing conferences and shared ideas with people all over the world. I would have thought, just relax, enjoy having the kids. It's a short time in life when they're that young. Just enjoy it. But of course, we don't have such magic wands and we can't see the future. But from those students' reactions, I think they knew what I was trying to say. And they can't know any more than I did. But they might at least know that it is possible to be in the situation I was in, with no job, very little money, two kids rushing around the place needing looking after, very little time to work, and yet to end up having a really interesting, I stop at the word career because I don't think it justifies being called a career, but a very, very interesting life, including lots of research and lots of writing.
One of the most powerful literary evocations of an iron grip on a narrow, fearful notion of success and life itself comes from Thomas Mann's novella Der Tod in Venedig, or Death in Venice. The personality of the protagonist, Gustav von Aschenbach, is summed up in a single gesture. You see, Aschenbach has only ever lived like this. And the speaker closed the fingers of his left hand tightly into a fist, and never like this. And he let his open hand hang comfortably down from the back of the chair.
Thank you for listening to the first of our 5 podcasts on overcoming a sense of academic failure, which focused on the feeling of failure. We invite you to continue listening to the next in our series on failure and other people. If you'd like to explore anything raised by this discussion, please consider contacting your university's careers or counselling service. And do also let us know what you think by completing the feedback form on the Oxford Careers website at careers.ox.ac.uk/overcoming-failure. At the same address, you can also find a written workbook on the theme of overcoming a sense of academic failure, which covers similar topics to these podcasts, but also includes visuals, CVs of failure from some of our contributors, and a list of other resources.